Outside the Gates by Molly Gloss, 1986. Seeing fantasy trilogies tumble off the production lines as bright-colored and disposable as plastic toys, we curmudgeons hanker for the days when a fantasy novel was a rare, shy creature that lurked in the mildew section of used bookstores and was usually by MacDonald, Dunsany, Edison, or one Morris or another. As art, it was both odd and considerable, the passionate expression of a truly unusual mind. Without in the least meaning to, Tolkien changed all that by the sheer force of his genius. To the publishing industry, genius means profit. Sauron showed the industrialists where money was to be made, and so fantasy novels are now a modestly profitable industrial product, each one very like all the others. The rare, odd, real stuff remains, of course, but has found new shadows to lurk in, far from the hype factories. Young adult fiction can be such a place, although the label is clearly that of a consumer item, although the prizes in the field can bring in real money, and although a YA book may have, over the years, an immense readership, still YA novels, like all genre fiction, remain unnoticed by the heavy advertisers and the powerful literary critics. YA means no more than quiche to the real men who control real books. So far, even feminist criticism has done nothing to change this. We kitty litters remain outsiders. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe a book like Outside the Gates can only happen outside the gates. The passionate expression of a truly unusual mind, Molly Gloss's first novel moves with the certainty of experience. Its fictional world is established without preamble or apology. This is the way it is here. The gates of human society, kinship, compassion, are shut upon the child gifted with uncommon power, whose shadow is his truest strength. He must die in the wilderness or find there a new kinship, a deeper compassion. Every adolescent knows this country outside the gates and is living there right now. Adolescence is exile. Without using the heroic commonplace of one defeats many, Gloss's story is that of the child alone in the world. It strikes upon deep, universal troubles and fears. Beside the orphan Wren, there are archetypal figures such as the animal helper, familiar in folk tales worldwide. Here, a loyal and engagingly wolfish wolf. Wren's shadow is the power of mutual understanding with animals. Only when a perverted magic exaggerates this gift, at cost of everything else in Wren's mind and body, does it become the fairy tale gift of the speech of the beasts. Power over the animals. Such moral accuracy is characteristic of the book. The sense of animal presence is strong throughout the story, mostly delightful, but when Wren obeys the perverse will of the spellbinder, terrible. Human presence is even more vivid, though there are only four characters of any substance. Rusha, an older outcast who becomes father-brother-friend to Wren, a kind, timid, silent man, is so real a person that one accepts his ability to control the local weather as quite plausible. So again, there is a sudden and terrific power in the climactic scene when the spellbinder turns Rusha's mild magic into this. Rusha's face was dark and terrifying and unfamiliar. When he opened his mouth, he let out a great, terrible breath, a dark, billowing cloud, oyster-colored and huge and angry. The thing rose from his mouth and, with a long, heavy thundering, spread itself under the overcast sky. The single female character, an older woman, is both central and elusive. At the end of the book, Vren and Rusha are returning to her, but they don't reach her before the story ends. The gesture of reaching out, of embrace, is incomplete. There may be an element of incompleteness here in the book itself, but after all, Gloss is writing about loneliness and aloneness. The spellbinder, slave of his own power, is completely believable. A short, dark, bald-in-front, ordinary man, whose banal spell catches the reader just as it does young Vren, before you know it. The chapter, Whispers, describing the effects of that spell, is extraordinary. Throughout the book, the writing is skillful, the wording compact and exact, the tone quiet and, except for a few over-compressed phrases, musical. As in a well-made chair, each line is true and counts. The ethical concerns of the story are intense but unstated. No preachments. Nor is life here perceived as war, as conflict, as it is in so much of our literature that critics have actually taken conflict to be the essential element of narrative. The guiding image of this narrative may be discovery, finding home, finding strength, finding one another. There is indeed a final struggle between power used well and power used ill. It is almost without physical violence, but the moral violence, the intensity of guilt, despair, rage, is almost unbearable when the spellbinder forces friend to betray friend. Evil defeats itself, but at a high cost. There are no cheap victories. I find the book moving and valuable, and I think young readers will find it so, because in conception and narration, it is emotionally honest, clear through.